This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for online success that helps you build the perfect website to make your business stand out. Whether you're starting a passion project or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy for you to create beautiful websites, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place on your terms. Unless you're a pro coding design wizard, and confession time, I'm very much not, making a quality, good-looking website can feel like one of the hardest bits of business. That's why Squarespace is here to help you every step of the way, providing fully customizable professional layouts and templates to choose from. It can also take care of those fiddly bits like device optimization, paywalls, and invoicing. So if, like me, you're more at home with manuscripts than JavaScript, Squarespace is the tool for you. Head to squarespace.com/history10 for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code history10, that's history10, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. It's a dark night in May 1297, and the occupants of the small castle in the Scottish town of Lanark have turned in for the evening. A calm has descended. In the kitchens, all that can be heard is the dying crackle of the fire left stoked when the cooks retired to bed, and the scratches of mice scuttling around the reed-strewn stone floors. In the hall and the chambers, conversation has finished for the evening, giving way to the steady snoring of the men inside. Those men are an English sheriff called William Heselrig and his team, who are in town to oversee the sessions of a law court. Other than a few guards posted on the outer doors, everyone's asleep. Beyond the castle walls, even Lanark's town drunks are quiet, their songs giving way to the screeches of owls hunting the streets for their supper. It's as close as it gets to a silent night. Yet, through the night, there now comes a hushed patter of footsteps. Men's footsteps padding quickly through the town streets. There are 24 pairs of feet in all, moving in groups of 2 and 3 at a time, coming from different angles, but all heading in one direction, towards the castle. These shadowy figures have planned their routes meticulously, and it only takes them a few minutes to arrive at their destination. They tap at an outer door of the castle. A surprised guard opens it to see who's out at this late hour. It's just a crack, but it's enough. The men burst in and overpower him. He quietly bleeds out on the floor. Now they're inside, one of the intruders takes the lead. He's a strong, rough, charismatic Scotsman by the name of William Wallace, who has a reputation as either an inspirational leader or a no-good thief, depending who you ask. Wallace has a huge sword in his hands. He knows what he intends to do with it, and he knows exactly where he's heading. By torchlight, Wallace leads his men on tiptoe through the castle to the chamber where the sheriff, an Englishman called William Heselrig, is asleep. They quietly assemble outside his door, and Wallace puts his ear to it. He nods, and then, with a great roar, his men storm in. The sleeping men wake up with a jump, stagger to their feet, grab anything they can use as a weapon, and try to defend themselves. But it's dark, they're confused, and the element of surprise lies firmly with William Wallace and his pals. With bone-chilling screams, they set about the Englishmen, hacking and slashing and stabbing them. Amid this commotion, Wallace advances on Sheriff Heselrig, vengeance burning in his eyes. Heselrig is scared, and so he should be. He knows who this man is. Earlier that day, during one of his court sessions, Wallace had tried to start a brawl, then escaped before anyone could catch him. Heselrig also knows Wallace has no respect for Englishmen, royal officials, or anyone connected with the Plantagenet King of England, Edward I. He knows that Wallace is strong enough to use that massive sword to do some serious damage. And that's his last thought, because without a flicker of hesitation, Wallace raises the long blade in his hands and brings it down with a sickening crunch on the sheriff's body. As the blood spurts, he strikes again, and again, and again, until Heselrig is a butchered hunk of flesh on the chamber floor. Around him, Wallace's men are doling out the same treatment to every other Englishman they can grab, then stripping their bodies for valuables. Once they're done, they spill back out from the castle into Lanark streets. They whoop and scream as they set fire to houses, slaughter men, and strike the fear of God into the women and children they leave alive. Edward I thought he'd bullied the Scots into submission. He was wrong. And now he's about to find out just what a dangerous monster he's unleashed. William Wallace is on the march, and Edward's dream of ruling Britain as a new King Arthur hangs in the balance. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 12, The Reckoning.
Do you ever wonder how celebrities order food? Like, is Sarah Paulson a Diet Coke or a regular Coke girlie?
Some peasant Coke? No.
Or how does Sofia Vergara order a pizza?
No tomatoes. I cannot eat tomatoes.
Are you killed mushrooms?
Not really.
If these are the details you need, and I know you do, I have the podcast for you. I'm Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and on my podcast, Dinner's on Me, I take some notable friends of mine out to dinners in Los Angeles and New York City. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That thing was delicious.
William Wallace is a name lots of us know fairly well today, thanks to Mel Gibson and some slightly dodgy blue face paint. But he was almost as famous in medieval times. Chroniclers writing in the later Middle Ages describe him as a giant, with powerful arms, long legs and big hips, which always makes me think he must have had a nightmare buying jeans. One writer even says he stood 7 feet tall. Yet for all this later fame, in 1297, Wallace comes out of nowhere. In truth, he's a minor noble, just one of many who are fed up with English interference north of the border. His murder of Heselrig is spectacular, as well as being a strong statement of Scottish independence and a good hard slap in the face of King Edward I. But it's not immediately clear that he's a Hollywood celebrity in the making. Because at this point, Edward I has rather a lot cluttering up his inbox. In 1297, Edward's approaching his 60th birthday. That's old age in the medieval world. And Edward is beginning to show signs of the tough life he's led. His hair is as white as snow, and there are definitely a few more lines on his face. At this age, he might have hoped that he'd be able to ease himself into pipe and slippers territory, but there's fat chance of that. He has a shopping list of big problems, and in a way, he's only got himself to blame. In Wales, a country he thought he'd conquered by brutally executing the native leaders and building a network of fierce castles, rebellion just keeps on flaring up. In France, he has a full-blown crisis on his hands, thanks to a crazy deal he tried to do with Philip IV over the Duchy of Gascony, which has ended with Philip swiping the duchy and refusing to give it back. And in Scotland, where he's tried to make himself master of a country he has so little respect for that he describes it as a turd, the people hate his guts. What's more, Edward is running low on family. His wife and confidant, Eleanor of Castile, is dead, and talk of him marrying Philippa France's sister Margaret have not yet materialised. His brother Edmund has died too. His only surviving son, Edward of Carnarvon, is just 13 years old and isn't giving all the signs of being a king in waiting. So Edward has to get a handle on his problems quickly, and preferably not die trying. But in 1297, that's easier said than done. Half the battle is just knowing which mole to whack first. In an ideal world, he'd go and punish William Wallace's attack on Lanark in May 1297 with a demonstration of military might, teach the rebels a lesson, and stick a few heads on spikes. But it's not that easy, because in spring 1297, Edward is already preparing to head across the Channel to Flanders, where he's teamed up with the Count of Flanders to attack Philip IV on his northern borders. The theory is that this will put enough pressure on the French king to force him to cut a deal on Gascony. It's a decent plan, but it's one Edward's committed to and he can't easily wriggle out of. For one thing, the situation across the Channel is too urgent to ignore. For another, Edward has invested a massive amount of political capital on the preparations for the Flanders operation, too much for him to walk away from without losing face on an epic scale. The whole business has caused massive ructions with the English barons, who, in time-honoured fashion, are moaning about paying high taxes to fight foreign wars. There's been widespread dismay at Edward's policy of mass buying food supplies at rock-bottom prices, and a swingeing wool tax known as the maltote, in order to provision and fund his army. Some barons are outright refusing to go to Flanders, saying they're under no obligation to do so, and the whole thing stinks. In a bitter row with one of them, Edward says the baron can either go to Flanders with him or hang, but the baron calls his bluff, telling him that, "By God's name, I shall neither go nor hang." It's fair to say, tempers are running high. In addition to that, the English bishops have put the church on tax strike, so Edward has declared every churchman in England an outlaw, forcing them to pay fines if they don't want to have their lands robbed and plundered without the protection of the state. The whole thing is a mess, and to be truthful, Edward seems to be damned if he goes to Flanders and damned if he doesn't. If he goes, he's basically hoping Scotland sorts itself out in his absence. If he stays, he's basically folding in the face of political opposition, as well as kissing goodbye to Gascony for good. In the end, Edward decides it's better to go. In August 1297, he sails to Flanders with a pretty piddly army, mostly consisting of men from his own household, and with a notable absence of people waving him a fond farewell from the harbourside. Behind him, he leaves some very unhappy campers, bishops preaching hellfire and brimstone, and barons muttering openly about civil war. And it takes almost no time at all for the campers to get even unhappier. Because no sooner has Edward left for Flanders than, you guessed it, William Wallace is back on the march. Wallace has teamed up with another rebel called Andrew Moray, and they're headed, with a big army, to the town and castle at Stirling. This is one of the most critical strategic spots in the whole of Scotland, because of the bridge that Stirling Castle guards. It crosses the River Forth, the waterway which more or less cuts Scotland in two. It's a well-known fact of Scottish political geography that whoever controls Stirling Bridge basically controls the entire country. In early September, Wallace and Moray advanced from the Highlands to the north side of Stirling Bridge, forcing Edward's lieutenant in Scotland, the Earl of Surrey, to come and meet them with an army of his own. The English get to the south side of the river, then stand there scratching their heads for a while. The Scots are goading them to come and fight, but it's a dodgy prospect. They'll have to cross the narrow bridge to do it, two men at a time, and that will make them sitting ducks. Wallace tells Surrey, via messengers, that "We're not here to make peace, but to do battle, to defend ourselves and liberate our kingdom." In other words, bring it on, or you'll never hear the last of us. The Earl of Surrey ponders this for a bit, then decides to roll the dice, cross the bridge, and fight. Which is as bad a move as it sounds. The Scots wait patiently for about 2,000 English troops to get across the river, then they charge them with spears, doing all kinds of damage, and killing everyone who can't turn tail and either swim back or crowd back across the bridge. It's said that Edward's treasurer, Hugh de Cressingham, is killed and flayed, and his skin is used to make a belt for William Wallace's sword. Surrey realises he's made a terrible mistake. But there's nothing to do except demolish the bridge and then scarper back to the safety of occupied Berwick to lick his wounds. Lanark was embarrassing. This is a total disaster. When Edward hears about it, he's going to flip his lid. But actually, when Edward finds out about Stirling Bridge, he does something rather sensible, even if not very enjoyable at the time. Word is brought to him in Flanders that everything has gone belly up in Scotland and that the English barons are starting to talk openly of rebellion. The council Edward's left in charge of England advises him that there's only one move that can nix that sort of talk, cooling tempers across the country and showing a united front to the Scots. It's one of the oldest plays in the Plantagenet book. In September 1297, Edward is persuaded, rather grumpily, that he has to dust off Magna Carta and reissue it to his barons. That means he's formally agreeing to stop taxing the backside off his subjects, stop oppressing the church, and start ruling like a good boy. Edward doesn't like it one bit. But in the autumn of 1297, he does what needs to be done. Magna Carta gets a reissue, the barons start kitting themselves out for war in the north, and Edward buys himself some time to push ahead with his bid to get Philip IV to negotiate a truce and give him Gascony back. It's a reprieve, but it's not a magic bullet to solve all Edward's problems. The Scots still need to be dealt with. His barons and bishops need to feel like their king is on their side and not the enemy. As 1297 comes to a close, it's clear that Edward still has plenty of work to do if he doesn't want to end up like his granddad King John, who first issued Magna Carta. Edward has seen some wild times during his long life, but right now, he's flirting with full-blown meltdown. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. the very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. In May 1298, the streets of York are heaving with people. The warren of lanes around the building site where the city's huge cathedral is under construction buzz with thousands of strangers from out of town. The markets and taverns are jam-packed with customers, eating and drinking, buying and selling, meeting old friends and making new ones. The blacksmiths are in full swing, shoeing horses and mending armour. Some say there are nearly 30,000 people gathered here, lodging wherever they can in the city or camping in the fields around. That's double the size of York's regular population. It's busy because there are two big things happening in York. The first is a parliament. The second is the gathering of an army. These two things are connected. The parliament is rubber-stamping the money to pay for the troops, and allowing fed-up royal subjects to let off some steam on the many things that have been getting them down. The reason for the army gathering is simple. It's been assembled to launch Operation Batter the Hell Out of William Wallace. At the head of the army is Edward I. He got back from Flanders in March, having secured a truce with Philip IV, brokered by the Pope. It doesn't put an end to the war, but it does mean Edward still stands a chance of getting Gascony back at some point, most likely on the basis that he marries the French king's 17-year-old sister, Margaret. The truce in Flanders means Edward can now devote some proper and long overdue time to Scotland. And judging by the size of the army in York, he's determined to do things properly. This is a shock and awe size military force, of the sort that he took into Wales 15 years ago. He's not out to slap William Wallace down. He's come to conquer, to scorch the earth, spill some blood, and maybe confiscate the Scottish barons' estates and dole them out to his own English nobles, who, let's be real here, could use a bit of light bribery to get them back on side. This is typical Edward. 9 months ago, the guy was backed so far into a corner, his arse was turning triangle-shaped. But now here he is, punching his way back out of it. It's high risk, no doubt. Victory will put him back on course to being the new King Arthur, and convince his sceptical subjects that he's still got his royal mojo. But if he screws this up, he could easily go the same way as Grandad John. 1 minute you're granting Magna Carta, the next you've got a civil war on your hands and your barons are auditioning for a replacement. So what does Edward need to do first? Well, having an army of 30,000 at his back is all well and good, but when he marches into Scotland in the early summer, his biggest challenge is actually finding where William Wallace and his own, much smaller army are hiding out. That's not quite as easy as it sounds. Scotland's a big place, and Wallace knows it better than the English do. It's also not that easy to move an army the size of a football stadium around. They consume vast amounts of food, stir up ill feeling among the locals, and are prone to infighting when they don't have anyone else to pick on. By mid-July, Edward has been in the field for weeks, and his men have nothing whatsoever to show for it. In fact, he's on the verge of giving up. They're low on supplies, and Wallace and his rebels seem to have vanished into thin air. To add insult to injury, one night while sleeping in camp, Edward's horse has trodden on him, breaking a couple of his ribs. He's sore, out of luck, and desperate. But then, on July the 21st, when the English are camped near Falkirk, preparing to leave Scotland empty-handed, scouts arrive with news that finally brings a smile to the old Plantagenet king's face. The rebel army has been spotted. They were planning to stalk the English as they fell back, then attack them in the rear. But Wallace has got a bit too close, a bit too soon. And Edward, a man who has seen off Simon de Montfort and Mamluk assassins in his time, knows an opportunity when he sees one. He gives the order. He's going to attack immediately. Wallace realises his mistake, but he's not the sort of man to back down. Instead, he decides to give Edward a bit of Plantagenet déjà vu. He puts his men at the top of a hill, just like Simon de Montfort did at Lewes and Edward himself did at Evesham, which was the last time Edward fought a battle, now more than 30 years ago. But then Wallace adds a Scottish flair. He positions his men in four tightly packed squares, holding their spears outwards in formations known as chiltrons, which will make it hard for mounted knights to run them down without being gored on impact. It's a dare. If Edward wants a scrap, he has to take the huge risk of charging his men up a slope at these tightly packed spear traps. If he's too chicken to do that, he can scarper. Edward takes a moment to think about it. Then he decides to stake pretty much everything he has on a strategy he's seen fail twice. He orders his men to advance up the hill. Tens of thousands of English troops break into a hoof-pounding cavalry charge and heart-pounding infantry run up the hill at Falkirk. Many of them must be wondering if their king has lost the plot. And those that crash into the chiltrons find out why it's such a solid defensive formation. There are bloody screams as the sharp spears, bristling outwards like a hedgehog's spines, rip into soft flesh, and horses and soldiers are skewered like kebabs. But Edward is a wily old commander, with the benefit of age and experience. He gives an order for the knights on horseback to stay away from the chiltrons and attack a separate body of Scottish troops, who have bows and arrows instead of spears. Meanwhile, he orders his foot soldiers, tens of thousands of them, to soften up the chiltrons by hurling stones from slingshots, shooting arrows, and just pelting them with everything they can lay their hands on. With the disparity in numbers between the two sides, that straightforward strategy ends up doing the job. The storm of missiles that rains down on the chiltrons is so heavy that after a while, the spearmen can't protect themselves. They start to waver. And as spines drop on the hedgehogs, so the English seize their moment to attack, coming from all angles and breaking up the defensive formations. As any medieval battle commander worth his salt knows, once discipline goes, there's no getting it back. That's exactly what happens at Falkirk. Under the relentless assault of this gigantic English army, Wallace's bold rebels eventually lose their shape and start to panic and flee. Wallace escapes, but his reputation has taken a beating, and hundreds of his men lie dead. It's a victory Edward could hardly have dreamed of even 3 days earlier. It creates a big swing in the momentum of the Scottish War towards the English. This isn't just the first battle Edward has fought since Evesham, it's been the difference between survival and chaos. After Falkirk, Edward follows up with raids at Stirling and St Andrews before taking his army back to England with his dander very much up. The mood is triumphant, yet Edward knows it isn't exactly mission accomplished. He makes York the temporary capital of England, an indication that he feels this is going to be a long war, not a quick campaign. And on that count, Edward is absolutely right. Scotland isn't beaten by a long chalk. William Wallace is still at large. What's more, a young man called Robert Bruce, grandson of the guy who claimed the throne in the Great Cause, is rising to power at the heart of the rebel movement. That would be enough for even the most capable Plantagenet to handle. But it's not all that Edward has on his plate. As he marches into old age, there are plenty of other challenges facing him, and England too. And the biggest threat of all doesn't come from Scottish rebels or English barons, or even the French King Philip IV. It'll come from a source that makes trouble for the Plantagenets more reliably than any foreign enemy. An existential threat to the dynasty is right by Edward's side. It's his son, Edward of Carnarvon. A callow teenager in 1398, but a boy destined to grow up into the most unhinged and dangerous king England has ever had. We're going to get up close and personal with the wildest reign in the whole of English medieval history when we come back in a few weeks for season 5 of This Is History. Now, before season 5 comes back, we have a little gap. Because, as usual, I need to return to my cave and become a hermit to get all the writing done. But I'm pleased to tell you that the historical adventures are not going to stop in the meantime. We're taking a little hop across the channel to really get to know the only man who's got one over on Edward Longshanks. That's Philip IV, otherwise known as Philip the Fair. I'll be handing over the feed to my colleague and friend Danielle Cybulski, who's going to tell this incredible story. We'll both be back next week to tell you more about it. All I'll say for now is if you thought Edward was a psychopath, well, you'll see. Thanks so much for listening to This Is History. This Is History is a Sony Music Entertainment production. It's written and hosted by me, Dan Jones. The series producer and story editor is Georgia Mills. Louisa Field is the executive producer. Subscriber episodes are produced by Hannah Talbot. The mixing and sound design is from Chris O'Shaughnessy. The production manager is Jennifer Mistry. Kieran Lancini is the marketing manager. Matt Atchison composed the original music. The studio engineers are Gulliver Tickle, Joshua Gibbs, and Matthias Torres-Sole.